In November of 1978, the world was shocked by the mass murder-suicide in the supposedly utopian community known as Jonestown. Over 900 members of the People's Temple died that day. More than two decades later, people still want to understand how such an event could possibly happen. A new movie tries to fill in some of the blanks. It's called Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple. The story is told in large part through the voices of former members of the People's Temple. They remember the hope and optimism of the earliest days, as well as the signs of what was to come, often with haunting detail. Here, long before Jonestown, former member Janet Schuller recalls being instructed to drink punch and then being told it was poison. Jim Jones called it a loyalty test.
Well, it wasn't about our loyalty, because we were demonstrating loyalty all the time. Coming there, being there in the meetings, sitting, listening, you know, supporting, working. And I thought it had a lot more to do with Jim's sense of rehearsal. Did he feel like he was potent and omnipotent enough to really get people to kill themselves when he said so? And that frightened the hell out of me.
If you have a story about Jonestown you want to share, or a question about what happened and why, give us a call. The number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address talk@npr.org. Joining us now from the studios of Audio Post in Philadelphia is Noland Walker. He's the co-producer and co-writer of the movie. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Neil. Good to be here.
And we should start out by explaining your connection to the subject of the film. That woman we just heard from is your aunt.
Yes, she's my Aunt Janet. It's one of those kind of situations where Stanley Nelson called me up out of the blue. He's the director and producer of the project, and I'd known Stanley for a long time, but and we'd been friendly, but certainly not close. And he called me and asked me if I wanted to work on a film about Jonestown, and I, you know, obviously I wanted to, and tried to conceal from him how much I wanted to, because little did he know at the time, I had an aunt, uncle, and three cousins who were in People's Temple from 1971 to 1977, just before everyone went to Guyana.
And they all left before Guyana?
They all left before Guyana. There was a lot of communal living that went on in People's Temple, and my aunt and uncle were kind of conspiring to leave People's Temple as things became more and more unsettling for them. And they had a lot of children who lived in their home with them as their own, and they surreptitiously were able to adopt two brothers and then an infant, who are my cousins. And the other children they had to leave behind.
Surreptitiously, because this was a, by that time, people were describing it as pretty much of a paranoid organization led by a man who was obsessed.
Absolutely. It was a paranoid. I mean, there was a lot of compartmentalization, and everything, as I found out, I knew some of this through talking with my aunt and uncle over the years, but definitely learned more when I began working on this project, was that everything was on a need-to-know basis. Jim Jones had a group of young people who were, you know, eager, enthusiastic, and very dedicated. There was always the talk of the cause. And one of the things that was very clear, I think one of the Jonestown survivors, actually a man named Tim Carter, said to me the first time I talked to him, he said, the temple came out of the times. And, you know, they were in Northern California, and there was a lot of kind of human rights, civil rights, revolutionary foment going on. They were friends with Angela Davis. They were friends with Dianne Feinstein. They were friends with Harvey Milk. And there was all of this kind of possibility that people felt in the air. And so
there was one telling moment in the film, somebody, and I forget the name of the person, I apologize, but saying this was after the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy and Malcolm X. There was a lot of disillusionment in the air, but in the People's Temple, the dream was still alive.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. I think a lot of people who joined People's Temple were seekers and were looking, had been looking throughout their lives for something different, something other than what they had been raised to believe. Both in terms, somewhat. I mean, People's Temple was a political organization, and there were it was one of those kind of things. My Aunt Janet said to me when I interviewed her, she said it was whatever you needed it to be. It was like a kaleidoscope. Hmm. And if you tapped it just a little bit, the entire picture would change. And each person had their own kind of portal onto what People's Temple was.
We're going to play a montage of voices, former members of the People's Temple, describing how they lived and worked. This at the time when the People's Temple was located in a remote rural area in Northern California in Ukiah.
My week kind of ran like this. I'd work my regular job on Mondays, you know, 8 to 5. Then I'd work on files.
There were people who ran rest homes. There were animals to be taken care of. There were the publications. Everybody had a job.
Wednesday night, we'd have a meeting in Redwood Valley, and I'd go to the meeting for till probably 10 or 10:30.
We turned our paychecks over every time we got paid. And then we got an allowance, $5 a week.
And Friday, I'd go to work, and I'd get off of work, and I'd hop on the bus or drive the bus to San Francisco.
If I had to go to the doctor was taken care of, I had to go to the dentist that was taken care of, if I needed clothes that was taken care of.
And often on Saturday night we'd have planning commission meetings till 2 or 3 in the morning.
We would always try to let each other know next day, well, how long did you sleep? Oh, I slept 2 hours. You only slept 2? Well, I slept 1.5 hours.
And then Sunday we'd have a Sunday morning service, and then around 1 o'clock hop on the buses, drive up, drop people off in San Francisco, and drive up to Redwood Valley.
The longest I ever stayed awake was 6 days, and that's with no coffee. No, so nothing.
It changed over the years, but it was always busy.
Being in an environment where you're constantly up, you're constantly busy, and you're made to feel guilty if you take too many luxuries like sleeping, you tend to not really think for yourself. And I did allow Jones to think for me because I figured that he had the better plan. I gave my rights up to him, as many others did.
And Nolan Walker, that last point, I think, is absolutely critical to understand what was going on.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things to remember about People's Temple is that most of the members were young. My aunt Janet and Uncle David were among some of the older, not the older in terms of there were plenty of senior citizens, but they were in their 30s, and they were kind of seen as this kind of sage couple in a lot of ways, or, you know, especially in the early days. People were in their 20s, and they had a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm. And Jim Jones knew how to figure out, and this is from my understanding, you know, Jim Jones knew how to figure out who you were, what you wanted, what you needed, mm-hmm. and how to channel that and just put people on the path.
As we heard, people sort of understood it or didn't complain when it turned out to be, first of all, financial extortion and later right. sexual exploitation.
Right. Well, the thing was that was key was that everything was incremental. And that was one of the things that we really wanted to emphasize in this film was kind of, in addition to talking about who the people of People's Temple were, what they wanted, how they saw themselves, we wanted to talk about how quickly, you know, a large group of people can get moved one step at a time towards a very bad place.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Nolan Walker, talking about the new documentary, The Life and Death of People's Temple. Let's see if we can get some callers on the line. 800-989-8255 if you'd like to join us. 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Braxton joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Hi, yeah, so I was calling in earlier because when I was growing up, I used to have a friend that was a security guard at a grocery store my mother worked at. And he was one of the people that had to go up there after Jonestown and clean it up. And he would tell me about all the stuff that would go on, you know, with the bodies, how they would react and stuff like that. And I was wondering if in the film they interviewed people that had to do with the aftermath, not just the people that were there.
Nolan Walker?
Yeah, we talked about that a lot, but ended up not interviewing. I actually went to Indianapolis, and I'm not remembering the gentleman's name right now, and I apologize. But he was in the Army, and he was part of the Army Air Corps that went down there and evacuated. I mean, or was part of the cleanup, and he was clearly very traumatized by that.
My friend would tell me that the bodies would sit up and scream. He had so much trouble talking about it, but he just wanted to impart the story to me, to let me know, you know.
Braxton, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nolan, was it difficult to get these people to come after all these years and talk about their experiences?
Well, You know, for making films as well as everything else in life, timing is everything. And we had the benefit of the fact that a playwright named Lee Fondakowski, who had written The Laramie Project, was in process of doing interviews over the years with a lot of members of People Temple. In fact, they had spoken to my aunt and uncle. My uncle died not long after I began working on this project, so we never interviewed him. But they had talked to a lot of people, and kind of the inevitability of that play coming out and the fact that it was a documentary play where people's faces weren't going to be seen, but their stories were going to be told. And even at that time, my aunt went under an assumed name during the play. You know, she was Janet Williamson instead of Janet Schuller, you know. I think that began to move people towards the idea that maybe people are able to hear the story and think, wow, that could have been my neighbor, that could have been my friend, that could have been my brother, my aunt, my sister, or maybe even, I believe in some of those things, that could have been me. So sure. I think, so those things had a lot to do with it. But at the same time, you know, as an interview process, there was a lot of trust building that went on. And I spent a lot of time, you know, I'm on the East Coast and a large number of people, Temple members, are still in the on the West Coast. And so there were a lot of late night telephone calls where people were really, you know, I would feel bad because I was asking them to come home from work and tap into this reservoir of loss and sorrow that they had spent years trying to kind of come to grips with. But, and, you know, but we would be on the telephone for hours. And then, you know, I would call somebody else and they would say, oh, I heard you spoke with Gary last night. So that was the other thing I wasn't aware of, you know, so clearly, but there are a lot of people in People's Temple who are, it's no longer an organization, but those people are bound by experience for life. And so how we approached one person was, you know, very quickly disseminated. And, you know, if you talk to one person, the word got out on the line about you quickly.
In a video at npr.org, you can hear Jim Jones talk about growing up in Indiana, and his childhood friends recall his obsession with religion and death. We have a clip from the documentary at npr.org/talk. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get Elaine on the line. Elaine's calling us from Vacaville in California.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
At the time of the People's Temple, I was a visiting nurse in San Francisco, and I visited people of all ethnic groups, and I was amazed to find out how many different people were sending Jim Jones money. And I can think of one person in particular who was an elderly white female. And this lady, when she finally died, had a mattress filled with hundreds of thousands of dollars that she was sending to Jim Jones on a regular basis because she saw only one part of this man. And that was a part she thought was good, and she wanted to support that part. And I think a lot of people were sucked in that same way.
Yes, there's a clip from the movie I wanted to play. This is people talking about Jim Jones with a mix of love and fear. This is Hugh Forston Jr., People's Temple's member.
And he said, what you need to believe in is what you can see. He said, if you see me as your friend, I'll be your friend. As you see me as your father, I'll be your father for those of you that don't have a father. He said, if you see me as your savior, I'll be your savior. He said, even so, if you see me as your God, I'll be your God.
I'll be your God, Nolan Walker.
Well, you know, there are, Jim Jones came out of Indiana. We actually went to the town, Lynn, Indiana, where Jones grew up. And it's a little town on either side of a two-lane highway and with a lot of churches in it. And Jim Jones was always searching for a place to belong. They say he visited almost every church in town. And there was something about, you know, Pentecostalism and the emotionalism of it that he was able to tap into and able to make work. And when you listen to his, you know, as a kid, throughout the time my aunt was in People's Temple, she and my mother have always been close, and they remained in contact, which was not always the case with People's Temple members. But we went out on, you know, summer vacation trips to California, and I remember going to People's Temple, and I, at that time, had not gone to a lot of formal church in my life, and all I remember was it was loud and it was long, you know, and now looking back, you know, it was time for everybody, no matter what your thing was, he was going to bring it up and whip you up about it. And so, you know, Jim Jones also knew how to you know, play to the outside world as well. You know, Ronald Reagan very early on had given him a citation for citizenship mm-hmm. and community great works. You know, he was a darling of the political establishment. Rosalynn Carter had, you know, visited him and went on a tour with him when during the campaign of 1976. Jim Jones was clearly intelligent and could be charming. And he was also clearly very troubled and complicated as well.
Noland Walker is the co-producer and co-writer of Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple. The film is being released in selected cities. In April, it will be broadcast as part of the PBS series, American Experience. Noland Walker, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you,
Neil. Noland Walker with us today from Philadelphia. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.